This is a podcast by The Straits Times and Money FM 89.3.
Welcome to Asian Insider, a podcast series by The Straits Times. I'm your host, Nirmal Ghosh, and this is a special edition for which I sat down with Amitabh Ghosh, one of the most prolific writers of our time, of books outstanding in their range and depth. Amitabh Ghosh has written such classics as The Hungry Tide, The Glass Palace, In an Antique Land. The list is a long one. His books have been translated into dozens of languages and read across the planet. His most recent is The Nutmeg's Curse, Parables for a Planet in Crisis. So Amitabh, thank you so much.
Thank you,
Nirmal. It's such a pleasure seeing you after all these years.
And yes, it's great to see you.
And I have to say, I really absolutely enjoyed this. It's a wonderful book. Thank you very much for doing this book. So our relationship with nature is something you mentioned in this book. The fact that Western colonial powers in particular had set this this system where we have dominion over nature and so forth. And you documented what happened with the violence we've done to landscapes, the violence we've done to species and so forth. But you also refer to a potential reset of our relationship with nature. Do you see any possibility of that actually happening? And if so, do you think that's going to happen peacefully and voluntarily, or do you think that will emerge out of huge conflict and upheaval in human society?
Well, in the first place, I am very reluctant to use the word nature, because I think the word nature itself comes with a sort of enormous colonial baggage, you know, and an enormous baggage of violence that it carries. So I prefer not to use the word nature really as far as possible. Because, you know, the word nature in itself implies a kind of dualism, you know, between the human and the rest. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of, within that dualism, it purports to show, you know, to create a human subject that is divorced from nature and that is completely separate, you know. Whereas we know that we ourselves are composed of so many different species, you know, bacteria. The biome has, I mean, there are more bacteria living within us than anything else, you know. So in that sense, we are very much within that world of living things, if you like. Certainly, I do think that, you know, it's possible and necessary to move on from looking at the world from the prism of these two dualisms. I think it's very important that we move on and try and find some other way of framing the world. But if you just consider the difficulty of speaking about the world without using the term nature, and I can tell you, I mean, writing a whole book, I have to face that problem all the time. It's hard to see how we're going to leave these concepts behind. They've become so deeply embedded, you know. They've become so much settled into our ways of looking at the earth that it's very hard to see how we might change direction. But I think a change of direction is coming. There's no doubt about it. Mm-hmm. And as you say, I think this change of direction is going to be very conflictual. You know, it's going to be, it already is. This is the problem, you see. With the framing of the planetary crisis, and especially in relation to climate change, we tend to frame it, especially within the Western discourse, it's always framed as a sort of technocratic, bureaucratic business, you know, which is best left to the technocrats and the diplomats and so on. And actually, what really gets left out of it is that it is already a process of incredible conflict. Uh-huh. You know, the way that it's unfolding around the world is an inherently conflictual process. And I think especially people in the global south and poor people in the global south understand this very well.
It's interesting that you mentioned poor people, because I've been thinking also about climate change, you know, watching COP26 in Glasgow quite closely. And there were huge crowds in the streets. We've seen the emergence of the young activists like Greta Thunberg and so forth. And it was, I think, Boris Johnson who at COP26 warned that we might face some kind of revolution if we fail to adequately deal with the threat of climate change. And we have seen this anger in the streets. Do you think that there's a potential for that kind of revolution to come? But again, you said, as you said, it is the poor, as we know, who are worst hit by climate change. And it's hard to see the poor sort of rising up and getting you know, major change.
Look, I think it's been true for the last 10 or 15 years that everything that is happening in the world is happening against the backdrop of the climate crisis. You know, it may not be explicitly referenced, but it's very much present in the background. So if you think of it like that, if you think of the political and social sensitivity to climate change in the same way that we think of atmospheric sensitivity, I think it's very much more than most of us expected, you know. So already we see a profound destabilization of everywhere, really. I mean, who would have thought that Britain, which has for centuries been the very model of stability and political continuity and so on, would become so deeply destabilized by migration. And essentially, it was just migration that destabilized the country so powerfully. So in that sense, climate was very much behind the destabilization of Britain. And in the same way, we see a complete destabilization of America, you know. And I think we're going to see more and more of this. I think we're going to see more and more instability, more and more uncertainty. I mean, you know, you look at countries which for a while had some sort of glimmer of, normalcy. You know, you think of Egypt, you think of Myanmar, you think of India. All these countries are now really just, as it were, going in a very dark direction, you know. Uh-huh. I mean, Egypt literally has become unrecognizable. I mean, I did my PhD on Egypt, you know. Uh-huh. So I lived there in the 1980s and I've spent a lot of time there. Egypt now is literally unrecognizable in so many ways, you know. Egypt is losing enormous amounts of arable land to sea level rise. Salt water is permeating deeper and deeper into the Nile Delta. Uh-huh. And Egypt is a very fragile and vulnerable ecology, you know. I mean, to this day, it's really just the gift of the Nile.
Yeah.
So I think there is already some sort of revolution occurring. And when we talk about the poor being the worst affected, I don't think that the poor are, as you say, going to stage this this revolution. If anything, it's going to be a revolution from the right. I think that's what we're really seeing. I mean, you know, a kind of process of what we might call eco-fascism. You know, one of the marks of which is a sort of intense hostility to migration. So we are seeing that in the United States. We are seeing that in India. We are seeing that in Europe. So, and in all these places, this hostility to migration get superimposed upon Islamophobia as well. So I do think we are seeing this kind of, we are certainly seeing the rise of a new kind of right, you know, a right which is actually taking quite radical environmental positions of one kind or another. So, you know, when we say that the poor are the worst affected, you know, I think it's become a kind of slogan which needs, in fact, to be unpacked and analyzed very carefully. Because, you know, for the poor, of course, there is a sense in, I mean, so many poor people are losing their homes, they're losing their land and so on. But I don't think for the poor, let's say in India or in Asia or in Africa, climate change represents, as it were, an ontological crisis, uh-huh. you know, a sort of philosophical crisis. Uh-huh. Whereas for middle-class people, most of all middle-class people in the West, that is exactly what it is. They're basically seeing their expectations of the world disintegrate. You know, and that is what is so difficult for them. Here in America, for example, I think that people have for so long grown up with this idea of progress, that the future will always be better, that when they can now quite palpably see the future is not going to be better, you know, and it isn't. I mean, it's better maybe for a few billionaires, but for most Americans, the future is really unraveling. They can see that, you know, so many people in the Midwest, in the Great Plains, and you know, all these regions where once people had decent lives, their lives are just unraveling. You just look at the impact of this recent set of tornadoes in Kentucky. You know, the tornado sort of exploded over a region which has already been very badly affected by COVID. And it's been very badly affected by the opioid crisis.
Yes.
So, you know, we see now these multiple vectors unfolding across Middle America. I don't know if, I mean, sometimes if you travel in the Midwest, let's say parts of Ohio and Iowa and so on, so many rural communities have just become completely hollowed out. They can't maintain their schools anymore.
That's true. Yes.
You know, the rural communities are just completely dwindling. They have no medical care. So we are really seeing the onset of a kind of a crisis that is not going to go away.
It's not going to go away. And I mean, I hate to sort of turn this into a doomsday conversation, but I can't help wondering whether this will eventually be the downfall of our species. If we cannot collectively, if we remain mired in, if we regress into tribalism, for example, if we remain mired in great power conflict, for example, the US and China now, if we focus on all these issues and neglect the larger collective existential crisis, will we end up, you know, as, you know, tribal people sort of fighting over resources like water and so forth, and then the Earth's slowly becomes less and less habitable for our actual species?
I think that human beings are perfectly capable of ending themselves long before the climate does. And I think what we're seeing unfolding in between China and the United States is very, very worrying. I think it's leading in a catastrophic direction. You know, because the United States is, you know, by a long shot, more powerful than any other country. More than that, the United States is, it's not just the United States. You know, we've been living with this fiction of nations and so on. But in fact, what we have and have had for a long time is an Anglosphere, you know, which jointly has been sitting atop the geopolitical pyramid. And that's almost formalized now in these Five Eyes security agreements and so on. And the Anglosphere has so long been dominant in the world that I think it's psychologically impossible for them to accept that they might have any challenges. And I say this really out of a sense of a deep sorrow, really, because I think even a very well-meaning you know, Americans and Australians, on this, I mean, they may not even know it, but on this, they're completely unyielding. You know, I mean, they're absolutely determined never to concede any of their power to any other part of the world. I mean, and we see this increasingly. I mean, just look at this latest military budget.
Yes.
I mean, they voted to give the Pentagon more than the Pentagon wanted, you know, even though now it's perfectly clear that America's military spending is actually not effective. You know, they waste a lot of money, they spend money on things. It's a vast structure of corruption, which is why, in effect, Russia and China have been able to neutralize their military advantages, you know, especially with hypersonic weapons. I mean, that has really taken, I think, the Americans aback. And suddenly, just recently, there was an article by Michael Clare, who's one of the leading military historians, where he says that we should expect a war to come around 2027. Of course, he's, as an American, naturally, they can never let go of their prejudices. So he's projecting this date because he thinks that that's when the Chinese armed forces will in some way catch up or consider themselves to be on par with the American armed forces. What he doesn't acknowledge is that if that is actually the case, then the Americans have a huge incentive for initiating hostilities before the Chinese have caught up. It's just logical.
Yeah.
So I think all those portents are extremely grim. I mean, you look around America today, this has been the case for the last 20 years. The only institution that is trusted across America is the army. There is no other institution. I mean, look at Congress's approval ratings.
Yeah.
Look at the Senate's, approval ratings of any politician. The only institution that is trusted is the army.
Yes. What would be your last quick one? What would be your sort of words of advice or wisdom to the younger generation, the 10-year-olds and 15-year-olds growing up now in this world?
Well, I think they're coming into a very dark future. There's no doubt about it. I mean, even in the best case scenario, whatever we can do for climate, already we can see that the social and political destabilization is far outrunning even the damage of climate change. And the damage of climate change is going to be enormous. And climate change is just one aspect of the planetary crisis. We can see with, say, for example, this pandemic, again, what an immense blow it's been to younger people. So, I don't know about advice, but certainly, we can see that for young people who are growing up today, take your 9 and 10-year-old, they've spent almost a year completely cut off,
mm-hmm.
from their peers. And it's undoubtedly going to take an enormous psychological toll. And if you just look at the sort of unrest that occurred in America during the pandemic, I think it's just a harbinger of the future.
Mm.
The unrest on the right and the left. I mean, we see these polarizations becoming increasingly worrying. And we see also the movement towards authoritarianism. Look at the Boris Johnson's Britain. I mean, the ways in which they're trying to now criminalize protests. I would, of course, advise younger people to take a greater interest in climate. And many of them are, as you say, one of the bright spots of Glasgow is that very large numbers of people turned out, and especially young, angry people, But we are deceiving ourselves if we don't recognize that the other side have been prepared for this for ages. How was it that before COP21 in Paris, they were able to put 40 French activists under essentially house arrest? Obviously, they've been under surveillance for a very long time.
Yeah,
and it's the FBI has repeatedly named climate activists as the greatest threat. So, as far as state power is concerned, I think the gloves are off. They're going to come after. Look at the incredible sentences that they're handing out to climate activists. So it's impossible to be Pollyanna-ish about these things.
Right. Okay. Well, on that cheerful note, I should say, I don't know. Amitav Ghosh, thank you very much.
Thank you, Nirmal.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Speaking to you as always.
Great to talk to you.
That's it for this special edition of the Asian Insider podcast. I'm your host, Nirmal Ghosh. Join me and my expert guests for the next episode on the fourth Friday of every month.
The Asian Insider podcast channel is also available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and our audio app. That's AWEDIO. Like us and rate us.
you can rely on Atlas Butler for all of your plumbing and drain service needs. Our expert plumbers and drain specialists can take care of anything from a broken water heater to a clogged drain. One call truly does it all. Atlas Butler is built to keep you comfortable, and our plumbing services are no exception. Call today, get it fixed today. That's our pledge to you.
Atlas Butler is at your service. Call.